Pegasus Foundation. Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hi, Paul.
Hello, is this Doug Powell?
This is Doug. How you doing?
I am so delighted that you're part of the Quarantine Tapes, co-presented by Onassis LA and Dublab. It's such a pleasure to speak with you, and you ask me how I'm doing. My standard response now is that I'm doing better than the world.
Well, that's something, isn't it?
But it isn't very difficult either.
True enough.
What a time we're living through, and I'm wondering, Doug, how you have been spending these last 18 or 19 months of this delirious time. If you can give me a sense of it and a sense of where I might find you at the present time.
Sure. You know, when the lockdown started happening in San Francisco, which was one of the first cities to start requiring people to obey curfew and stay in and socially distance and things like that, I was at a poetry festival in Scotland. So I flew back in the middle of things, you know, people doing panic buying and all of that stuff. And I was set to turn around in 3 or 4 days and fly to Pittsburgh and to Hartford, Connecticut. I had all of this travel planned. So the first thing I had to do was deal with shutting all of that down, some of which was easy enough because the venues canceled for me. And then, you know, just trying to figure out how to stay sane in the couple of weeks that we thought initially it was going to be. And then as it became protracted, I had to really have a plan for how I would keep myself sane. I live a half a block from Golden Gate Park, so having that as my backyard has been very helpful. Being able to go out there and see raccoons and birds and squirrels and people on bicycles, flowers growing, trees coming back into bloom. That was very helpful. And also I started watching a lot of movies.
Tell me.
And I became very picky about my movies. I didn't want any bad stories. I didn't want anything that was going to depress me. So at first I was watching a lot of big, splashy Technicolor musicals. I went through everything that Carmen Miranda had done. I went through every Esther Williams movie I could watch. And then I sort of branched out into those big, extravagant, widescreen films from the 50s, like Picnic and Giant. And even though there were some sad storylines, it felt like color and range would save me.
And do you feel it does offer solace?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like art in general is a place where we can escape from the mundane. I know one of my great influences in poetry, Robert Duncan, would say things like, why repeat the redundancies of your ordinary life? Why not use poetry as a place to escape into the magical? And I don't feel like I do that so much in poetry, but I certainly do it as a consumer and viewer of art. I love things that transport me to some place where I don't have to think about my own life.
I wonder how you would react to, you know, I'm a quotomaniac by profession, and I wonder how you would react to this this line of Iris Murdoch, because in a way, when I thought of it, it made me think that it could very well resonate with you in another register. She says that only the greatest art invigorates without consoling.
Invigorates without consoling. Yeah. I do feel like that is closer to the truth of art, because I know people think rather sentimentally that art will heal you and will cause great catharsis. And I don't know that that's true, but I sometimes feel like being lifted into someone else's story, into someone else's world, allows me to displace my own concerns, my own phobias and fears, and to relocate into some other reality. I mean, it's a little bit like religion. I feel like there's no accident in the fact that movie houses are built a lot like churches. You go and you have your sermon, but you don't have the interactive quality, which is often the part of religion that's a little scary anyway. Particularly, I've gone to a number of churches over the years where I am walking in as a stranger, as a gay man, and I just feel like, you know, I'm not sure how these people are going to treat me or respond to me. So I much prefer going someplace where I can simply sit in silence and meditate and listen rather than having to interact with people.
You know, about 7 months ago, you wrote this, which is quite haunting. You said, if you wrote a single line for every person in the United States to die from COVID, you would have an elegy of 500,000 lines. It would occupy roughly 10,000 pages or 20 reams of paper and would weigh approximately 100 pounds. If you wrote an elegy for each as each deserves, that would be 500,000 pages and counting, and would weigh in manuscript form over 5,000 pounds. Imagine a book of that size. It still would not equal to the loss that it contains. And in the introduction to Tea, you write, I honor my dead in the attempt to recapture their voices. And I'm wondering how those phrases of yours and that line I quoted from Tea, the introduction to Tea, resonates with you now, 18 months later.
Well, that's so astute of you to tie those two together. I remember writing that tweet, and as you read it back to me, my first thought was, wow, I'm much better at math than I thought I was. But when I was writing Tea, one of the first things that I was doing, even though I didn't know quite what I was doing, you know, I was just beginning that book, and I thought I would write an elegy for each person that I knew who died of AIDS.
Right.
And it became overwhelming very quickly, and I was sinking under the sadness of it, and I thought, I don't want this to be that kind of book. I want it to be a book about survival, about the possibility of getting through this, not being overwhelmed and drowned by it. And so I had to make an aesthetic shift, which was to start speaking through other voices, human voices, fictional voices. At one point, I wrote a poem from the point of view of a swarm of insects. I did one from the point of view of a building. And it was just that feeling that if I had to be mathematically accurate to the loss that I experienced, I would have a loss so big that it would weigh me down wherever I went. And if I went for a swim, it would certainly drown me.
I mean, the last line of your introduction is so moving to me. You say, this is not about being queer and dying. It is about being human and living. And that is, in a sense, what you were just expressing a moment ago. I read this extraordinary interview with you in a journal I do not know called Cut Bank. It's about 15 years old, and you quote Marianne Moore, and that line of Marianne Moore that you quote haunts me. And we're talking about the enormity of grief. And here she writes, quoting herself, Heraclitus, "Compression is the first grace of style."
Yeah, right. And that certainly has become sort of a lodestar for me, that idea that, you know, Basho says something similar, which is, what's the use of saying everything? And I think, you know, as poets, we need to be able to filter and reduce without sacrificing emotional truth or historical truth, and being able to find a way to suggest the largeness of loss or the largeness of one's emotional truth without enumerating all of it. It's really tricky. When I was doing Useless Landscape or A Guide for Boys, my subject matter was the Central Valley of California and, you know, the ecological impact of the various ways in which it has grown and changed. And I realized that there were a lot of stories that were getting left out because I was, for one reason or another, not the person to tell them. And so there's a moment in that book where I have this series of unfinished landscapes where I allow other voices to come in and speak about the experience of Japanese internment, for example, or the experience of migrant workers who are able to work the land but never to own the land. And, you know, being able to sort of step aside, lay aside one's own emotional truth and allow other people in, it's something that I've learned from watching and listening to jazz.
To jazz?
Yes. A good musician is a good listener.
Right.
And I think the same is true with a poet, that it's not just enough to be generating words. You have to be stepping back and listening and letting the words speak to you, and sometimes letting in words that you didn't even know would be a part of your thinking.
You know, John Cage says that listening is already an act of composition.
Yeah, yeah. I would have been happy if you had said, John Cage said, listening is already, and left it at that. That would seem like something just as possible for him to say.
Well, it's interesting, right? You in a way, you just performed what Marianne Moore said when she quoted Heraclitus. You made something even tighter, as it were. And in that same interview, which is really an extraordinary interview you gave some years ago, you say the following: after all, a poem is not an argument. As Emerson said, arguments convince nobody. We look at them, we weigh them, we turn them over, and we decide against them. And then a bit lower you say, I think of Hart, Crane, and Marianne Moore as two poets whose lapidary diction and acute visuals create a world quite suited to their tastes for the carnal on the one hand or the rarefied on the other. I happen to be as comfortable in back alleys as I am in museums, so I choose language that registers in both places, and I don't mind the shifts from the sublime to the duende, from Roman Catholic to Roman orgy. Tell me more.
Well, I mean, you know, I have to thank really my first poetry teacher, David Bromage.
Yes.
Who was so instrumental in, first of all, giving permission, which I think is terribly important for young writers, to say, look, you have some authority. You are able to say and do whatever you want. But to kind of lead me away from, you know, the one thing I excelled at in high school was speech and debate. So I knew how to construct arguments. And David would say, you know, you're not here in the poem to convince people of your truth. You're here to explore the possibilities of truth and let somebody else decide what is and isn't takeawayable from the poem. And he was certainly a great practitioner of the kind of double-edged sword that I love in poetry. He had a short poem that consisted of two lines: save time, kill it. And I think, you know, having the poem pull in two very different directions like that is something that pleases me deeply. And so I will often follow up high diction with low diction or vice versa, so that nothing feels too predictable.
So interesting. It truly I mean, it inspires so many different thoughts in me.
When Frank O'Hara writes in one of his poems, he's talking about killing himself, but in a very grandiloquent way. He says, "I only need one bullet, preferably silver." And then he says, "But I hate all that crap." Oh, he says, "If you can't be something, at least you can be a legend. But I hate all that crap." And I think, "But I hate all that crap" is something that I want to put in every poem. And in some ways I do.
Doug, I wanted you perhaps to comment on a passage that you found, and perhaps tell us how you found it. A passage from Mark Strand's copy of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. And you had occasion to discover it. Not only did you discover it, but you gave us to read a few pages from your discovery with what I always love is the underlinings, which are sometimes very problematic when you go back and look at your own underlinings and you truly wonder, what was I thinking? What was I feeling back then? But there is this underlining in the poem, a line that means so much to me, which I'd love for you to perhaps unpack a little bit, where Walt Whitman says, "My voice goes after what my eyes cannot see." And then a little bit lower, "Speech is a twin of my vision. It is unequal to measure itself." Can you tell me a little bit why you were interested in it and how you happened upon it?
Well, I was staying in Italy for 6 weeks at a castle in Umbria called the Civitella Ranieri. And I received a fellowship to stay there in a very nice room for a castle with bats and all sorts of birds living around. It was really idyllic. And in the center of the main room of the castle, there's a library. And Mark Strand had donated thousands of books to the library. And the castle doesn't have the sort of staff where they can just go through everything and catalog it all at once. So many of the books had ephemera, letters inserted, little scraps of paper, notes. And one evening I was in the mood to read Walt Whitman, and there were several volumes there, but I found the one that was the most banged up, the most worn, and that was Mark Strand's copy that he had when he was an undergraduate. And so you can see in the margins him really trying to figure out exactly what's going on. He writes "sex" with a question mark in the margins. And then a few pages later, he writes "sex" with an exclamation point. Like he's figuring out who Whitman is. And of all the passages that he had commented on and underlined, that was the passage that had all the underlinings and stars and check marks. And like you could tell that it had really resonated with him. And I think that there are two ideas there that are similar. One is that art is an extension of our senses and can be a kind of a set of ears or a set of eyes that go to places where our own eyes and ears haven't yet traveled. Like Jory Graham says, I don't write a poem to tell you what I know. I write a poem to find out what I think. And I think that the other part of that, the voice being twin to vision, is that there's some effort on the part of poets that I admire, including Mark Strand and Walt Whitman, to have a feeling of authenticity that is beyond merely describing the world or beyond saying what it is that you personally think or feel. That if your vision is in fact larger than what your own set of eyes can conquer, then your voice also has to be there as well, which means that you have to be willing to say things that sort of terrify you, things that you didn't think that you would be capable of saying or thinking. In fact, you have to say things sometimes that you don't agree with, because you can't just come at every subject directly, like you're hacking your way through a forest with a machete.
You have to come at it slant.
Yes, yeah. Like Polonius's advice to Laertes when he's sending Laertes to spy for him. And he says, you know, don't go at the subject directly. Proceed with windlasses and assays of bias. You know, sort of tack your way in like a sailboat.
You know, I didn't read the line in between the two. The first line being, my voice goes after what my eyes cannot reach. And the following one that I read, speech is a twin of my vision. It is unequal to measure itself. But in between, there is, which I don't think Strand underlined, with the twirl of my tongue, I encompass worlds and volumes of worlds.
The twirl of my tongue, yeah, right. You know, I admire people who trust their senses, but I'm constantly challenged by, you know, did my eye in fact see that correctly? Did my ear hear? I know that I hear things all the time. And sometimes I would much rather have the misheard be represented on the page than what I literally heard, which often is not as interesting.
You were talking about those days in the castle in Italy, in Umbria. I made me immediately yeah. want to just parachute myself into that space. And you were talking about the library, but you were also talking about the natural elements and how perhaps they had an effect on you, whether it was trees or birds. Did they, and if so, how?
Oh, very much so. The funny thing is, before I went to Italy, I had another residency. I was on my sabbatical, so I had the freedom to sort of, you know, immerse myself in other worlds. And so in October of that year, prior to going to Italy, I spent a month in Kentucky at a research forest, at a forest that had once been completely clear-cut land and was now being studied for the ways in which species returned. You know, how the nitrogen fixers would go in first, the legumes, and sort of replenish the soil, and how the beech trees would go in and sort of hold the soil in place so that other species could grow. And then to go from that environment to this castle in Italy, which was an example of a man-made space that, you know, part of the castle had been damaged by earthquake. The castle had been occupied by German forces during World War II. So there was some damage to the exterior of the castle from, you know, the liberating forces. And, you know, to see how over time all of these plants would grow in the cracks and crevices of the castle, and birds would find their way in, owls and starlings and swallows, and being in a place that felt like it wasn't just a building, it was an environment, a living space. There were bats that danced through the air in the castle all the time.
Did it inspire you to write about that environment? Did it inspire you to write about the birds and the owls and the bats and whatever else you...
Oh, very much, yeah.
Did you write any poems about them?
Well, I did write a poem about an owl when I was in Kentucky. And I think using the word about is misleading because... What I was doing was playing with the letters of the word owl itself and the various combinations that those letters can make and the sounds that come out of those combinations.
Might I encourage you to read that poem?
I'd love to.
Thank you.
The title of the poem is First Strains. I meant strains in the sense of music, but also taking a nod to the poet Ronald Johnson, this sense of strain, like straining towards meaning, straining towards understanding. And because I don't speak owl, I had to find a way to converse with this owl. This is called First Strain. Owl, oh owl, low owl, low owl. Owl, oh owl, ooh owl, woo owl, low, low owl, low owl, oh owl, oh owl, oh, oh owl, low owl, oh owl. Restricting myself to just those three letters gave me a limited palette upon which to work, and I felt like it was closer to owl speech than I could ever get if I was just using human words.
Are there other poems you have written where you attempt to capture, as it were, foreign language?
You know, I tried a couple of other attempts, and this one was the only one that came out really pleasing.
So musically compelling.
Yes, musically compelling, and. What I remember about poetry when I was a child was that I often didn't know what the poem was about, but I could still memorize the words because the sounds had their own pattern to them. And even though there were words in the poem that I didn't know the meanings of, I still felt the meaning of the poem through the musicality, through the vowels, through the consonants, through the patterns of rhyming. And I'm always sort of intrigued by nonsense, and there will be times where nonsensical kinds of things show up in my poem. And sometimes people want to know more about that, and sometimes they don't. I mean, I feel like we're all capable of nonsense, but how many times do we really resort to it? Except in moments of extreme emotional register, when we feel like the only response to the world is nonsense. I'm surprised there aren't more people writing nonsense right now, given all of the things that we're going through.
It's so interesting, Doug. We began by talking about the incommensurate nature of the loss, the grief, and we went from nearly an impossibility to register what now is, you know, approaching 700,000 or 800,000 lost lives in this country, to go from that to nonsense coming in a way to give us a lending hand, poetry being a way perhaps to help us.
When the ancient Greeks and Romans went to the Sibyl, or to the oracle, they would get language that they couldn't quite understand. And yet, over time, it would reveal itself. You know, like Sylvia Plath writes about the fat of the lamb surrendering its opacity. I feel like language sometimes can be very opaque, and over time will reveal its meanings to us. And so I've learned to trust those moments where I don't quite understand what I've written or what's going on. I have a poem that I wrote recently that had that same sort of, I mean, it's not like the owl poem. It's different. It's similar in that it's short, but...
Read it to us.
Okay.
Read it to us.
All right.
I interrupted you. You were about to say something about it, but I just want to invite you to read it to us.
I'll definitely read it. All I'll tell you is that it begins with, the title is "The Wolf Now Swims Among the Sheep," which was a line that I found in Ovid's Metamorphoses. When Zeus decides that the world is evil and that it needs to be destroyed, he finds that out by going to the home of this king who entertains the gods by serving them human flesh. And he thinks this king is so reprehensible that he sort of uses this force to push the king out the door. And as the king goes out the door, he's transformed into a wolf. And we sort of forget about him, but later when Zeus calls Poseidon to raise up the winds and to release a flood against humankind, there's this moment where Ovid says, "The wolf now swims among the sheep." And I'm like, is that same wolf? So just having that question in mind was all that set the poem in motion. The wolf now swims among the sheep. The hardest part of a bird is its eye. The hardest part of a man is his heart, so he will tell you otherwise. A hide is called a hide because it hides behind a thick-skinned wall, the worst of what's inside us all.
Oh, I love this.
I feel like I'm channeling Kay Ryan in that poem. And if so, I owe her a drink.
No, I love this. I mean, there's the playful quality is so tangible. And I've read somewhere that you said, "I do think that a word has an interior life, a light that radiates force. When we handle language as makers, we're not, for the most part, inventing language from scratch. We're working with these things that already have a life and a history. Our job is to use them in such a way as to extend their life, not to destroy it."
Well, that was a very articulate way for me to put that. I'm glad I said it that way. I feel a little bit like I'm reminded of the first time I met Eytal Adnan, who was a early friend in poetry and someone who encouraged me. And she said that she felt that words were like coins and that, you know, they got dirty over time being handled by so many people. And that the poet's responsibility was really to shine up that coin so that people saw it as a new thing again.
Beautiful, a beautiful way. I mean, I'm always reminded in a completely different register, but one that might register with you, when Tom Waits says the world is a hellish place and bad writing is destroying the quality of our suffering.
Yeah, right. Bad writing can often make us think that the words themselves are the problem. And it's not. I think that any word, if used at the right time and in the right context, can create a moment of intense illumination. Just knowing that that words have that way of, you know, comforting us when we need comforting, inspiring us when we need inspiration, challenging us when we are being complacent, setting fire to the world. It all begins with the power of language and the power to convey our emotion. You know, Charles Olson says that the poem is energy transferred. And so I sometimes like to tell my students that, you know, a poem is an opportunity to take whatever energy you're feeling and to put it someplace else, to put it into a poem so that other people can feel that energy as well. And I think for myself, sometimes what I'm doing is trying to get that energy off me and put it in the poem where I can close the book, where I can sort of have it safely in some other context where it doesn't eat away at my heart or brain.
Overwhelm you. I mean, coming back again to the beginning of our conversation, you know, how can one grieve, memorialize so many people who have died, so many people whose lives have been destroyed? And you know, often one thinks of you as a poet who in some way addressed the AIDS crisis. And of course, now we're going through another crisis, which is this pandemic. And
yeah, I'm still living through the last pandemic.
Right.
So, you know, I certainly understand the ways in which people are confounded and confused. And I wish that my experience of the first pandemic were more applicable to this pandemic. But of course, you know, I was living through a pandemic where people were demonized for having AIDS, for having made the mistake in their life of getting infected. Whereas we don't quite have that now, but there's always this danger that people who are COVID positive are going to start being treated as second-class citizens. It's kind of happening in small ways. And when I see people complaining about being forced to get vaccinated or, you know, being required to wear a mask, I feel like, you know, you don't even really get what's at stake here and what kinds of damage can be done by not being a part of the solution. I mean, it's okay to, you know, not have any regard for your own safety. That is something people do all the time. But to not have regard for anyone else's safety is something that we usually punish in, you know, like if someone's driving drunk, whether they hit someone or not, they're guilty of breaking the law. But, you know, we're being much too tender about people's rights to possibly infect other people.
Tender or reckless.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a very different attitude when it was just primarily gay and Haitian and other people who were seen as less desirable members of society, people who were not considered a part of us. As Vito Russo pointed out in the documentary on the AIDS quilt, when he talks about the headline in the Time magazine saying, "Now AIDS affects the rest of us." And he says, "Am I not us? Am I not a part of us? Did it have to literally, you know, get into the population of people that we, quote, care about in order for somebody to do something?"
Doug, in closing, I would love you to read a poem of yours that you wrote during this time called Palm Sunday. Perhaps you can you can tell us something about it. I found it utterly haunting.
Oh, well, thank you. I wrote it on the 23rd of March. So this was, you know, not even 2 weeks into lockdown here in San Francisco and still very early in the pandemic. But already I was going stir crazy because I had gone from, you know, traveling and enjoying people and having all of these wonderful experiences. And suddenly I'm like, where am I going to find toilet paper today? That would be the sole mission. And it was a week before the Easter holiday and all of the usual Passover and Easter themed movies were playing on the television, and I thought, I'm just going to sit down and write a poem. I did have in mind also Wallace Stevens' poem, Sunday Morning. Palm Sunday. What a beautiful day for a plague. 2 days left until Passover. Still plenty of time for frogs and boils and blood. The live oak sends out its pollen abundantly. Good thing we're all wearing our masks. When Christ rode into Jerusalem for his Seder, there were no masks. There were no gloves to protect him from the Romans or the crowd, the leopard and the scald, the gold and gall. The fronds beat but did not purify the air. Imagine being cleansed by someone's blood. It seems a paradox of epic proportion. Sunday mornings of no complacencies and no peignoirs. Were the Gospels his memoirs? If so, we know he tired of being touched. Even holiness has limits. I turned on the Ten Commandments last night, right when the angel of death was coming. Bad timing. Right when the oak was putting out its pollen and the glorious bench was calling forth its song. Jesus Christ Superstar is on. Yasha reminds me I once said the secret ending to all poems is now blow me, the way the secret ending to all fortune cookies is in bed. Is it any comfort to hear that a lame man took up his bed, or that one Lazarus was lifted of his sores, another Lazarus lifted from behind a rock? So this is not that movie. That was The Greatest Story Ever Told, which is too wide to watch on television. God of Israel, God of Islam, God of the whole box set, I do not know if I can sit through another Technicolor plague. That angel has not forgotten where I live. Goldfinch hovering. My friend Lucy used to say she bought all the movies she wanted to see before she died. And now she worried she'd never see them. Then she died. I hope she saw the Venice of Senso or Death in Venice. No matter what, at the end of an Italian movie, it always says, fine. Things work out fine. La Dolce Vita's fine. Everything is rosy. It seems a fine way to end. Oh, God, now blow me.
Doug, thank you so very much. With this, we will bring our conversation to a fine, to a finale.
A finale.
Thank you so much for spending this time with us, and I'm
really... Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you so much for asking me. This was a joy to get to talk with you. I've so enjoyed your Twitter and your show, and it's really wonderful to get to be a part of it.
Thank you so much, and I hope in time, since we're nearly neighbors, we'll meet in person.
It'll happen, because you know what? I am making sure that I'm living through this.
Let's make it both of us.
Let's make it both of us.
All the best to you. Take good care.
All right. Thank you, and amen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.